Well, hello there, auto enthusiast friends that are roaming about on this great big planet we call Earth. Yes, it's true. You push the button again. You haven't learned yet. You've hit play on yet another...
another licit episode of V8 Radio, Kevin.
Licit.
Licit.
Right on.
As in the opposite of illicit.
I know. Which would I rather be, licit or illicit?
I don't know. What's going to give us the more listens? I don't know.
Licits? We're going to start calling them our licitors.
Cut. Start over.
What? All right. Illicit means like illegal. Like
correct.
Like verboten.
Yeah. Yeah. Illicit means not forbidden or lawful.
All right. So this has to be a lawful episode?
Yeah. We have to keep it above board today, man.
Oh, all right. Well, this is the V8 Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Oste, joined as always by our esteemed co-host, Mr. Mike Cuball Clark.
How are we doing today, my man?
We're doing good. We're doing great.
Yeah, yeah, you look it. You suck with your 70 degrees.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a lot going on today. You know, it's February. It's Daytona Day today. Daytona 500 is running right now. And we got a really nice weather weekend here. So I'm in my garage, and I've got the big roll-up door open and the Buicks in the driveway, and I got a short sleeve shirt on. Look, I'm squinting because of the sun.
Stop yourself.
And it is like 70 degrees here today.
Yeah, I'm wearing a coat. I'm wearing a stocking cap so my head doesn't freeze and my garage door is down.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, there you go.
You'll get there. I'm just trying to soak it all up right now.
Yeah, as you should.
And you know what else takes a soaking? You, me, and all the listeners, thanks to our V8 Radio trivia contest that we have every episode.
God. Oh, we're off to a great start. Oh, yeah, gee whiz.
It's all downhill from here.
Yeah, here we go.
So we ask a trivia question in the beginning of the episode, usually automotive related. And then, you know, of course, at the end, we reveal the answer. And if you had the fortitude to stay with us, you'll find out the answer. And boy, will you sleep better if you know.
See, we're really providing a service here.
Right. Uh-huh. Helping you sleep.
Yeah. We are your sleep study. You're welcome.
Please wait till after the show.
Oh, my goodness.
Do you have a trivia question?
I do have a trivia question. But before we get into that, I have to offer up a concession. On one of our trivia questions. It seems that on our show from December 18th, 2021, I asked you a question regarding what aerodynamic technology was available on fifth gen Z28s and HD Silverado trucks. And your answer was something like flush mounted glass. And of course, that wasn't what I was looking for. However, I got the question wrong. So I made it impossible. So, <I'm> right. So I made it impossible to answer correctly. So I'm going to have to give you the win in that column. I'm going to have to ask our official V8 radio statistician, Yardley, to open up the archives and go back to that 1218 show and mark a win in that column for Kevin.
Uh-huh.
And so the question, the correct question was, what aerodynamic technology is shared between 5th gen Z28 Camaros and 2019 Silverado medium duty trucks? And I know if I asked the question correctly, you would have gotten it immediately. But because of the way I asked it, I made it impossible. Therefore, defaulting you with the win, my friend.
Well, there you go. And the correct answer to that was the flow tie.
The flow tie. See, you knew.
Yeah.
Right away.
The bow tie thing in the grill that helps do things that we can't really describe. But it was great.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Well, hey, I appreciate that.
So congratulations. You're already a winner.
That'll make up for the three in a row from the
yeah, right.
The thing in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, pretty much. All right. So,
well, all right, go for it.
So good stuff. All right. So the real question today is, Kevin, you remember when, remember those keys that GM came out with? They had a little coated resistor on them for part of the security. Well, when did GM start using that? And for the bonus, what car did they initially use that on?
That's called the pass key, right? I think that's what
it could be. Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well,
and it's identified. You see on the side of the key, it's got that looks like a little thing there. You can't quite put your finger on it. It's got a little black plastic surround.
Yeah, it's a little chip, resistor of some sort. Mm-hmm. Well, the story that I'm aware of, and I don't know if it's true, is that in the cities in the United States, Chicago, California, New York, I think Miami, Dallas, the Chevrolet Corvette in the 1970s and early 1980s was the most stolen vehicle in the country.
Oh, wow.
And at one point, there was a statistic in the city of Chicago that your new Corvette, under certain circumstances, if you left it, you know, parked on the street in certain mm-hmm. areas, you had an ownership lifespan of 24 hours before the
Good
thing got stolen.
Gravy.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Right. And, you know, I think at that time, that was the end of the C3 generation, which came out in 68. And those cars, you know, thieves figured out how to get into them, you know, mm-hmm. by then. And a Corvette, you know, it's a plastic thing. So it wasn't very hard to jimmy one open and steal it. So I think they created the passkey system. Primarily, it was launched in the Corvette to help reduce that theft rate. Mm-hmm. And my recollection is it came out on the 84 Corvette, the Gen 4 Corvette, C4 Corvettes. And it was part of the technology package that they were heralding, trying to convince people to buy them because, you know, if you bought one and it got stolen that day, you know, that wasn't good for sales and it wasn't good for insurance premiums.
Right.
And also not fun.
Not much fun. You can't see the USA in your Chevrolet if it's stolen.
Right. Somebody else can, but
you. Yeah. Yeah. The guy who ripped it off sure can.
Right. Uh-huh. So that is my story and I'm sticking to it.
All right. So Kevin says 1984 and it was launched for the Corvette.
Yeah.
Due to high theft. All right. Duly noted, sir.
I mean, at least it sounded good, right?
It sounded great. It sounded phenomenal.
Okay. All right. Y'all ready for this?
Yeah. Lay it on us.
Okay. Well, today, as we mentioned earlier, is Daytona 500 day.
Boogity, boogity, boogity.
That's right. So let's go back in time a whole 20 years.
Okay.
What was the 2002 Daytona 500 pace car, and why was it significant?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. All right. This is going to be good.
Start your engine.
Yeah, man. Okay. So, yeah, typically every car that paces the Daytona will have, and there'll be a consumer version that can be bought. And it has the graphics package and all that good stuff on it. In 2002, I'm going to say the pace car was a Grand Prix GTP.
Ooh.
Mm.
I mean, oh.
And I'm going to say the significance is it was the first front-wheel drive car to pace the Daytona.
I mean, interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
Pontiac GTP, the Grand Prix GTP.
Yep.
And you had something like that, right?
I did. I had a 99 GTP. Man, that was a quick car.
Yeah. Yeah, those were neat.
Yeah. And yeah. Okay. The supercharged 3.8 liter Buick engine.
Yep.
Mm.
First front driver on the high banked super speedway. I added a little bit at the end there.
Yep.
All right.
We were all thinking it.
Yeah. That, I suppose we'll find out.
We will find out at the end of the show, Kev.
Right on. Well, we have a couple other quick things.
Yeah.
You had posted in our our shared show notes. We have notes, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, we do show prep once in a while.
Yeah, every 16th episode, there's one line.
And we got to build a whole show around it.
Yeah, in a text that says, hey. But this time, you posted something shared from Mr. Vince Walburn, right?
Correct. Yeah, he left us a really, really nice review about our show. So thank you, Vince, and I'll go ahead and read it for us. Great entertainment and always informative on the state of the car culture in the world. Talk of the auto restoration and repair business, car shows, tools, and life with an old car is always on tap.
Wow.
A definite feel of, quote, Americana that is hard to find in the podcast world. Mike and Kevin are always great to listen to. Time well spent.
That is amazing.
That is amazing. Yeah. I love this review. This is awesome. Thank you, Vince.
Yeah, that's about the best one ever, I think. Mm-hmm. And not because he's being kind to us, which we appreciate. But I'll tell you what, it hadn't really dawned on me until I read this review that I think one of my life's dreams was to create some sort of Americana.
Well, there you have it.
And according to Mr. Walburn, you know, we did for him. So that's really awesome.
Dream achieved.
Yeah, right. So very cool. Of course, anybody's welcome to share the reviews. This one was on the Apple podcast platform. But that was very nice. So thank you so much.
Yes, thanks again, sir. Appreciate that.
Let's see. I have one more interesting comment that was posted today, actually, in a Facebook group. So our last episode, we chatted about the Firebird Fest.
Yes.
2022 coming to our small town here of Waterloo, Illinois. And the organizer of the Firebird Fest listened to that episode.
Oh, great.
Which was cool. And he said, for those who want to listen to Kevin's announcement on his podcast, you can go to the 24-minute mark to hear him talk about Firebird Fest. Of course, you know, you can't start in the beginning too if you like, but
yeah, you're always welcome to,
right? But I get it. Let's get to the point.
Yeah,
Kevin is a well-known restoration business and restored many Firebirds for folks all over the world, including cars that came to Firebird Fest 21. Kevin's podcast is well known, and he is one of the most reputable businesses in our industry and does great work. I think he means our team does, because I'm Mr. Mediocre. Kevin also attends many national events and travels the world teaching folks about classic cars, auto mechanics, and restorations. He's a great guy, great resource for all things classic cars, and has a great appreciation for Pontiac Firebirds.
Right
on. Thanks for promoting Firebird Fest. So there you go, man.
Very cool.
Who's the Pontiac guy now?
That'd be you, man. That'd be you.
Only for this episode, I guess. So, but yeah, people have been very nice recently, so thank you.
Even though I used to own a Pontiac Firebird, but don't let that sway anyone's judgment.
Right. You did.
Yeah.
You did.
Yeah, 77 formula.
I painted one, a 68 convertible. Mm.
That makes all the difference.
Yeah.
All right, Topper, keep going.
I've worked on a large couple of handfuls at our shop. And I've walked past our crew working on many more.
Yeah, right. All right.
Those cars actually have really, they've been such a presence in our existence, in our business's existence, in my existence.
Mm-hmm.
And it all started, you know, for you and I, guys our age, with Smokey and the Bandit, of course. And,
sure.
You know, we all know the story, but they just never seem to go out of style.
No, absolutely not. I remember a few times seeing some photos that you've shared with cars in the shop, and it is like F-body mania in that shop sometimes.
Sometimes it is.
Yeah.
And again, the great thing there is when we share a build video series on a particular car, other people watch that and go, hey, well, do something to mine, and they send it in. So we get them in flocks, I guess, of birds, Firebirds. And it's great. The nice thing is every one of them ends up being different. It's not like we're building a series of
cookie
the same
cutter,
car. Over
car
yeah. yeah. So like right now, we've got a supercharged LS car. I think we have a non-supercharged LS car. We have a Pontiac 400 car. We have a what started out as an Olds 403 car that's going to a Pontiac 455 car.
Cool.
You know, so every possible, you know,
many factory iterations. Offered
and other modified platforms. So that's cool.
That is cool. Right on. I love seeing the variety.
Yeah, right. The variety of the same car.
Even the LS cars, you know, it's all good.
Do what you can. So speaking of the video series, we put out the final chapter in our 57 Thunderbird build series last week, which, of course, you were the opening voice on. Thank you for
that. Right. It was your boy helping you out.
Yeah. And we've gotten a lot of great feedback on that series, too, because that car, also a bird, but a Thunderbird.
Correct.
That story kind of hit everything. It was, yes, it's a car, and yes, we modified it with a new chassis and a Coyote motor, and we showed, you know, how we did all that. But this was a car that had a strong significance, not the VIN on this particular car, but our customer's dad was a big Thunderbird enthusiast, and he had a whole bunch of them over the years. And he unfortunately passed away, but our customer bought one because she wanted to, you know, keep that memory alive.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the one she bought was a bone stock 57, and she drives like modern sports cars and did not like it. She's like, oh, this is not what I expected.
Right.
Which was kind of a letdown, because now she's like, you know, can you imagine, you know, I want to keep this tradition alive, and my dad loved these, and you get behind the wheel and go, why did he like this?
Yeah.
You know, and he might have really enjoyed the way they drove, but if you're not used to that,
right, exactly,
the big straight up and down steering wheel and you know, a carburetor and things that, you know, you just didn't grow up around. So by breathing new life into that car, it now allowed her to go out and use it and stay connected with her dad, and she's driving the wheels off that thing.
That's fantastic.
And it is. It's super cool.
Yeah, that's what we all hope for when these things come out of any shop or any type of build is completed, that you're able to drive the wheels off of it.
Yes, and it does what it's supposed to do. And you don't have to be a hardcore car enthusiast to enjoy that. I mean, that's not really her angle. Her angle is really about the nostalgia and the family connection.
Mm-hmm.
And it just happens to be through this super cool thing on wheels. So,
and it is super cool.
Yeah, it came out really neat. I mean, I really enjoy driving that one.
I bet it handles like crazy.
It handles really well. And it's we've been getting a lot of interesting feedback. So the first two chapters, it's a three-chapter video series. You can find it on YouTube or on our V8 Speed Shop website. The first two chapters were a little bit of that story and then kind of getting into it and showing, swapping the chassis. But we made sure not to, there's a couple teasers of the car driving, you know, but we didn't do a full feature till the end, of course. And it stirred up a lot of people that were fully anti this project.
Really?
Oh yeah. And it's purists, and they're like, you know, you could have fixed the original Y block and it would have drove perfect. And you know, the white walls and the wire wheels are so much better than a modern wheel with a bigger tire. And, you know, how dare you put a fuel injected engine in this thing? And a Coyote engine is, you know, modern plastic junk and all this stuff. And really got, you know, lit up pretty hard. Which I expected, you know. It still goes along my philosophy that I don't know why people have to get so angry about something they don't dig. I mean, if somebody crashed into you with the car, I could see it.
Yeah, I can see you being upset, but
but you know, you don't have, but whatever. So the chapter three, when we pull it all together and kind of tell the why, it's been one of our highest like to zero unlike ratios ever so far. So
great.
People are really they're either getting over it, or, you know, only the ones that like the project stayed through to the end, maybe to watch it.
Maybe the people who have nothing good to say aren't saying anything.
Hopefully they're all in tears because of the storyline. Because I kind of was.
Yeah, right.
But one of the interesting comments we got was somebody said, hey, you know, you put that Coyote engine in there, which is a 5-liter overhead cam, you know, modern Ford V8. You should have put a Godzilla motor in it, which is the new 7.3 liter Ford gasoline V8, which it's an interesting engine because Ford, you know, I don't really want to say this, but it has striking similarities to a big block version of an LS.
Really?
The design is very similar to a General Motors, you know, Chevrolet LS engine. And I don't think Ford, you know, took a picture of an LS and blew it up to 7.3 liters and said, here it is. I just think that those principles work in what they did.
Uh-huh.
You know, the head design and the block and the casting. And then, so they needed to replace the Triton V10 in the trucks.
Okay.
So that's what this engine's for.
Shame on me. I call myself an industry guy. I was not familiar with the Godzilla engine.
Oh yeah. It's coming on. And you know, like everything these days, availability, I guess, is a little tricky, but, you'll start to see them. And the cool thing is that a stock like Ford truck Godzilla makes like 300 horsepower, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you put a small amount of boost on one of these things, and there are guys making like 1600 already.
Holy cow.
And they're staying together.
Wow.
And it's not an overhead cam engine.
Really? It's a pushrod engine.
It's a pushrod, yeah. So this guy was like, hey, you could have put one of those in that car because it's not as wide as the Coyote and it would have fit better and you could have made more power.
Right.
And I thought about it. And, you know, interestingly, when we did our first Coyote swap Thunderbird a few years ago, it was a 55. Uh-huh. And that one had already had an engine swap. It had a 460 in it. And it wasn't finished. And we talked to the customer and found out what he wanted. And he wanted a nimble, you know, performance sports car kind of thing, like what a Thunderbird's supposed to be. And the 460 was just too big. It was too heavy.
Uh-huh.
So it turns out the Godzilla motor is 300 pounds heavier than a Coyote.
Really?
Yeah.
300 pounds heavier?
Yeah. A Coyote's only 446 pounds. Jeez. I mean, it weighs nothing. So that was the first thing, because the car is tremendously well-balanced with that lightweight V8 in it. And the next thing is, like I mentioned, a stock Godzilla is like 300 horsepower, but a stock 5.0 like we used was 450, you know, 460. And the stock part of that is important because this customer, again, is an enthusiast by driving only. So she didn't want something that idled crazy or was super loud or had a bunch of aftermarket parts on it that couldn't get serviced at our local dealer. And so we needed something that was like warrantied, factory built, put the number on the board. And that was all considered when that car was built. But it got me thinking, that Godzilla motor, cause it kind of looks like a Windsor, like a regular Ford V8, but also again, you know, dimensionally it's kind of like that.
Yeah.
But that'd be cool in like a 66 Galaxy or something.
Whoa, boy, howdy. Yeah, it would.
And right now, if you jump on the Googles, you'll see people doing Fox bodied Mustangs with them.
Really?
And they're just terrors. I mean, they're just insane.
I bet.
And there, a lot of people are taking the race car route. And I think because there's such, you know, animosity against the LS crowd of people putting LS engines in those Mustangs and stuff, that they wanted something that they could bolt in and really clean house with. I haven't seen too many, you know, resto-mod 60s muscle cars or earlier with the Godzilla motor yet. But when somebody wants one, we would love to do it. I think it'd be really cool.
When did that engine become available?
I think it's a 20 or 21 model year. Yeah, but I think because of the world being so screwed up, it's been kind of flying under the radar.
Okay.
And in true typical fashion, like all good V8s, they started out as truck engines. You know, because that's where the mass quantity of production is. That's where the money is.
Yeah.
And then the high performance versions weed out. And if this was Chevrolet, it would have been in a Corvette and then all the trucks and then all the cars.
Right.
But Ford already has the Coyote and the Mustang. So they didn't.
True.
They're not building a Godzilla Mustang from.
Yeah. They don't need to.
Right. So it's a kind of a different rollout. You know, like the Shelby GT500s and the supercharged. I mean, they're unbelievable as they are. You know, if you change that engine up, and somebody's going to do it. You know, for sure. But
well, yeah, probably.
Yeah,
I can see that going into it a vintage Mustang. That'd be a great fit.
Yeah, it would.
It'd probably clear the shock towers and everything.
Right. It's not much bigger than a Windsor. I don't think it's as big as a big block Ford motor was, like an FE.
Okay.
Those came in 67, 68 nut Mustangs.
So. Yeah, that's a no-brainer. It'd probably be, for a high-performance part, would probably be a lot cheaper than Coyote parts. From what I understand, it's pretty expensive to hot rod a Coyote engine.
It depends on what you do.
I mean, if you want to put cams in there, you're looking at four cams.
Correct. Yeah.
So versus one.
Right.
Yeah.
And there is, there's a lot more support for those at this point.
Sure.
But again, I think every Coyote swap we've done, we've had to move the brake booster over and engineer something because they're so wide.
Yeah.
So there's
makes sense.
Money spent in development to get something to fit. But again, that lightweight engine is just,
oh yeah, that's an all aluminum engine, that Coyote, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. They're so nice. So that's all cool.
That is cool, man.
And then I spent this weekend. So last show, we talked a little bit about, the broken bolt.
Yeah. I'm ready to hear the conclusion on that.
You know, it's funny about that too. Since that episode aired, I think I've gotten 3 texts from people saying, hey, if you need help getting that bolt out.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
That was very cool.
So what ended up happening?
As soon as we got done recording our episode, I went right back to work on it and I re-chucked up my, reverse pitch left-hand thread drill bit. Not the special machine tool, just a backwards threaded drill bit, and kind of jammed it in there, and it grabbed that end of the bolt, and it just spun right out.
Nice.
So it was halfway hung up, like I was talking about, around the gasket material and in the stuff in there, but I think a little bit of it was still in the block, and it just went zip, and it fell right on the floor. And I was like, here we are.
Here we go. Onward and upward.
The strategy worked because the bolt remnant had a hole drilled right through the middle of it.
That's beautiful.
Through the thread. So the plan worked. It didn't hurt the threads in the block.
Yeah.
I threw a new bolt in and bingo.
Uh-huh.
So I drove the car last weekend and it didn't drive very well. I was a little bit concerned. It was, it's kind of shaky and, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And I should have known. I mean, I stabbed the distributor back in and started it, and it ran. It ran well, you know? So I'm like, good, we're done. I didn't even put a timing light on it or anything. So this week, yesterday, as a matter of fact, I said, you know what? Let's go back to the basics, and we'll do a proper tune-up on this thing. So I threw a new set of spark plugs in it. I put some NGKs in it this time, which I do like those plugs. They're just the base model V-Power cheap ones, but... And I reset the timing, and I had a vacuum leak on the distributor vacuum advance, so I fixed that. And then I changed the choke opening speed, you know, moved the twisted the black thing on the electric choke, and set the idle. And I used a tack, I used a timing light, I used a vacuum gauge, I used, you know, everything. And I set the timing to the factory spec, which is so funny because who... You know, really, who actually looks at the factory specs and says it needs to be at 6 degrees before top dead center? That's where I'm putting it, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody's an expert.
Yes, they are. They're like, you gotta time it with the vacuum gauge, and that's what you got to do, or time it by ear, or don't listen to the factory spec.
Yeah, it's too conservative. Put 5 more degrees in it or whatever.
Right.
And on the vacuum gauge, it ran great, but it still pinged under throttle. It detonated.
Oh, really?
The centrifugal advance would kick in, and it would be too much.
Too much too soon, huh? Okay.
Yeah. So I said, you know what? No, I'm putting it 100% to stock specs because it's a 37,000 mile engine with a new timing set. So it should be, you know, back to,
yes,
back to spec. And I even put the original snorkel air cleaner back on.
Good for you, man. Right on.
Well, I don't want any variables. I just, you know, let's zero this thing out.
Yes.
It does have that Demon carburetor on it, but other than that, it's, you know, it's pretty much stock. And the electronic ignition. But, oh my God, does this thing run awesome.
I bet. That's awesome. Yes.
It starts perfectly. It wasn't running very smooth, and I, you know, messed with the idle air fuel screws to smooth the idle out. And, you know, because it had a little occasional pop, pop, you know, little kind of miss stumble here and there because it was lean, and I fixed that. And it's like glass. It is just.
That's terrific, man.
Took it for a drive, and it's the best the car's run since I've had it. And it should be.
You know? Yeah, it's cool when you have an older car and you don't have to do like a series of extra steps to get it to start and run properly. I mean, you do exactly what was meant to be done when the car was new. You stab the accelerator twice, you turn the key, it fires up. Yeah. It's not like you have to keep the key going, keep the engine cranking, you're pumping the gas, or you got to get out and throw a screwdriver into the choke well to get it to start, or any of that kind of nonsense. It's as it should be.
Well, and this car was kind of going in that direction of having to do those crazy steps. And it turned out that, so this car is a factory in-tank electric fuel pump, which is, you know, unusual. But originally there was this oil pressure switch on the side of the block. And when the engine is running and it's making more than, I think, 3 or 4 PSI, a circuit closes and the fuel pump is allowed to run. But if you, for example, get into a crash and the engine stops, oil pressure goes to zero, and then it turns the fuel pump off so that you don't have the fuel pump spraying an electric pump pumping fuel, you know, in a dangerous situation. So the problem with that is over time, you know, you turn, and if the car sits for a little while and the fuel drains out of the carburetor, as you're cranking it, it's not making enough fuel or oil pressure right away to turn the pump on.
I gotcha.
And then when it does, it's got to pump from all the way in the back to all the way up in the front, fill the bowl. And if you did your two-step throttle already, there was nothing in the carburetor yet.
Right.
So not only that, when I put the electric choke on it, the choke is timed. So the amount of time it took to get the oil pressure up, get the fuel brought from the back to the front, get the fuel in the bowl, and then spray it into the thing, the choke was already opening.
Oh, because it's electric.
Because it's electric. Right. And it's a certain amount of time before it opens up on its own. So then it wouldn't start properly, and it would be real rough and blowing smoke and everything.
Yeah.
So I backtracked through all this to figure out what was going on. And it turned out that the spark plugs I took out were all gapped at like 45 thou.
Okay.
Which I think was done. I think the gap opens up a little bit over time on this thing.
It seems a bit much.
Yeah, but we did the Petronix electronic ignition conversion.
Okay, so you got a hotter spark.
Hotter spark, right? Yeah. So a 45 thou gap is like GM HEI territory.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I went back to the Petronix instructions and it doesn't say anything about gap. So I think at the time, and this is, I don't know, 5 years ago now, I thought, yeah, it's an electronic ignition with a new performance coil. Let's open that gap up a little bit because it's going to be a better flame front and all that. No, it turns out that Petronix says, yeah, if you want to open it up 500 thousandths.
Oh, boy.
Just a super tiny bit, which basically means don't do anything.
Right.
So the stock spec on this is a 30 thousandths plug gap.
Oh, boy. So you had it was open quite a bit more.
It was open
15 thousandths extra.
150% more than it should.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Oh, boy.
So I put the I gapped a new set of NGK plugs, put those in, and then I slowed the choke down so that all that stuff could happen and the choke would still be closed. And then I jumped out the oil pressure switch and put an electric jumper wire so that as soon as you turn the key on, the pump is running.
The pump is going to come on. Oh, that's great.
And it's, you know, again, anti-safety feature. But like in my Galaxy and the fuel injection cars we do at the shop, we put a, it's actually a Ford part, an inertia switch that we put in the trunk.
Sure. Yeah.
It actually has a big ball bearing in it, like a buckshot ball.
Oh, yeah?
And it sits on a contactor. And if the car gets hit, it knocks that ball off and it turns off the fuel pump. That's that's the circuit.
Okay.
So I'm going to put one of those in the car so it'll still have the safety function.
The safety feature. Okay.
But it won't depend on the engine oil pressure. It'll depend on an impact.
Sure. That's great. So because you have that electric pump, you just have to turn the key. Say you haven't started the car in a month and your float bowls are empty. You just have to turn the key and it's going to fill those float bowls for you.
Right. And so I thought that'd be great. But again, at the same time, the choke was already coming off. Because even if you just turn the key on, if it's dry, it's going to take 10, 15, 20 seconds.
Sure.
You know, to get enough fuel in there and then, you know, you pump it and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I slowed the choke down. And now that's the concept. If it sits for a while, just turn the key, let it sit for, you know, 10, 15 seconds. Then slowly squeeze the gas pedal a couple times. It'll set that choke valve in place. And then it starts. I mean, it's like half a rotation.
Doesn't that feel good?
Just boom.
Yeah.
It's great.
I love it. Love it.
Yeah. And it doesn't leak. So the whole point of that whole project was to fix the front crank seal.
Front crank seal.
Which is fixed. Doesn't leak.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Well, that's a good byproduct of all this work you did.
Yeah. The actual original goal was achieved.
Nice.
For now, anyway. And that's the, you know, the enemy of these cars is a lack of usage. And that's when things dry up and they start to leak. So it might leak again, but right now it does not. And then the interesting little side byproduct was that putting that stock air cleaner back on. So I had an open element, you know, filter. And that had two problems. One we talked about before. It was so flimsy that you tighten the wing nut and it would bind up on the throttle linkage.
Right.
And it wouldn't idle down because it would hang up on that. Mm-hmm. So I figured that out, and when I put the stock one back on, of course, it clears everything, but it's so quiet,
you know,
because it's an enclosed thing.
Yeah.
And the hot rodders are saying, well, you just choked out, you know, 15 horsepower or whatever, because it's breathing through a snorkel now.
It's a luxury car, my friend.
Well, yeah, exactly. There's that. And if I really want to, I might punch a few holes in the bottom of it or something and give it a little breathing room. But maybe it's probably because of the new timing chain and the tune-up I put on it.
Mm-hmm.
It performs better now than it ever has.
Oh, that's great.
So I'm not missing my airflow benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And we did do a air fuel gauge tune on it last year and set the metering rods and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to check that to see if I'm... by restricting the airflow, if it's running perhaps a little rich.
A little rich, perhaps. Yeah, I got you.
But we'll find out. It doesn't feel like it. I mean, it just feels great.
Mm. Well, you can throw an air fuel. You probably throw something in the tailpipe, couldn't you, that's going to measure air fuel?
Well, I have fittings that we welded into the...
Oh, you do? Okay, perfect.
Yeah, they've got a bolt cap in them now, but you can unscrew that and slip in a...
Throw an O2 sensor. Oh,
yeah,
great.
Oxygen sensor and measure that. Yeah, we try to tune all the carburetors with that.
Yeah, for sure.
So you're not guessing.
Yeah, you don't want to guess with that, especially if it's something you're going to put a wide open throttle. You definitely don't want it leaning out. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Oh boy.
So you know how it is when you knock out some bigger projects, then the smaller stuff comes back into focus. You know, your mind goes looking for things. And there were a few other annoyances on this car. sun visors would slowly droop.
I know that struggle.
As you drive. And so would the rearview mirror. It would slowly droop.
Uh-huh.
So I went through and cinched all those down. And so far, they're dynamite. I don't know. I remember tightening those in the past. I don't know if I was just being conservative on it or if they did it truly loosen up.
Mm-hmm.
But right now they're like they're stuck. They're good. Not going anywhere. So that's good.
Nice.
I'm sure the first time I grab it and flip it down to block the sun, it's going to...
The screw's going to come loose and that's it. It's
going to fall out, yeah. And then there was another little side project that had me stumped for a while. The car would go dead every once in a while in the garage. The battery would just go to nothing.
Oh, I think I remember you talking about that before.
Yeah, and I was blaming, you know, cheap batteries and all this stuff. And what I found out is it was the glove box light.
Ah.
This car has a light. It's a luxury car.
It is a luxury car.
With an illumination source in the glove box. And over time, the latch had worn. It loosened. It didn't wear. It loosened.
Okay.
So the it's a pin switch, a push button switch on the bulb. And the strength of that spring was enough to push the door away enough to turn the light on.
So
it appeared closed.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. We'll tighten up that latch. Well, that's like nearly impossible.
Is it? Oh, gee whiz.
And to describe the mechanism, so you look at this car, the front of the dash has wood grain trim. Mm-hmm. And in that trim is where the twist knob is for the glove box. The door is below that. So the, like, I think on your car, on your car and most, you know, Camaros and GMs and a lot of, you know, Mustangs, the latch is in the door itself.
Correct. It's a little push button. It pops the door open. Yeah.
In this case, it's not. The latch is above in the dash.
Oh,
this,
so this fancy. Trim.
Yeah, right. So what ends up happening is you've got your twist knob and then the trim. And then there's a like a lock nut behind the trim, but in front of the dash steel. So it's captured behind the trim. And then the latch mechanism is threaded inside from the back. So in order to fix this, and the whole thing loosened up. So we're just kind of wobbling and spinning in the dash.
Okay.
To fix this, you got to take the tumbler out. You got to take the knob out.
Oh, boy.
And the key slot. And then go inside and remove the latch assembly. And then figure out how to put it back together and tighten it up.
And yikes.
There, of course, there's a trick, and Kelly was, you know, Kelly knows the trick on all this stuff, and she was looking at it, and at first I just wanted to get the thing to close again, because it was so loose, it was hanging open.
Right.
And on most of these locks, you have a pinhole on the side. You put a paper clip or something in there, and it pushes all the little tumbler fingers down so that they can slide out of the hole.
Correct.
And this has that same kind of thing. But you got to also work the latch itself, a little spring-loaded grab latch.
Oh, sure.
So I'm under the dash. I find the hole. I push the thing. I grab the little latch. And bing, the knob actually ejected out of the car. It lands on the floor. And the latch popped upward and landed on top of the inside of the glove box.
the whole thing, whiz.
It just disassembled itself.
Oh, my gosh.
And then I could see that little nut inside the dash. So I brought the whole thing over to the bench, and I'm assembling and disassembling it on the bench, you know, to get the feel of how this thing works, and lubed it up and, you know, made it all nice. Put it back in the car and realized that to tighten the lock nut, you need a very large hex key, essentially. It's like an Allen wrench.
Okay.
Because there is no way. It's an inside surface. It's like an Allen, you know, like a cap screw, I guess.
Yeah.
And you can't get any other kind of tool on it except for that. So I went, oh, man, that's a weird one. But, of course, I got up and went in my toolbox, and there it is.
Hey, how about it?
Yeah, I got a couple of nice sets and clicked it back together and torqued it down, a little drop of red Loctite, and blammo, the glove box works perfectly again, so.
Heck yeah, man.
I know. And it's sunny and warm. It's just been a good day.
These little projects really are satisfying.
They are.
Yeah.
And even when you got to go back to the book and put aside, you know, what you think you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that.
I know how to do this.
Yeah.
Well, let me show you how to do that. You know?
Yeah, I'm usually like that, but with with this car, I actually enjoy going to the book because I like seeing, learning how the factory put things together. Mm-hmm. And just, you can see the exploded view, like, oh, they did this and they did that. Okay, that's cool. Well, I can just, you know, grip this and turn that, and Bob's your uncle. I have this apart now.
Right.
And just learning how they engineer things is what really kind of gets me going.
Yeah, and Trevor in our shop has a quote he uses every once in a while. You know, GM had buildings full of engineers mm-hmm. that figured this stuff out along with the service procedure. And when we're building a car like that Thunderbird, taking all these parts and putting them together, you know, we're just, you know, 20 technicians on a Tuesday. You know, we're not right. GM yeah. or Ford or Chrysler with their resources.
Yeah.
So, you know, as much as, you know, it could be a male trait to not want to look at the instructions and figure mm-hmm. it out on your own, if you got them, you know, you're going to be a lot happier.
Mm-hmm. So absolutely.
Read the book. And those are little victories, like you're saying, and little victories are good because that's the gratification of this hobby, if you will, is, you know, whatever happens to me tomorrow at work, I'm not going to, I won this weekend.
Yeah, man. I'm a wiener.
That's right. So it should be all good. So the goal is to take this car on a little road trip up to Chicago in April.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good.
We'll see you and some friends up there. And that ends up being about a 1,000-mile trip over the whole weekend. And one of my wheels is bent. This car had stamped steelies and hubcaps mm-hmm. originally, and I put a set of Buick road wheel, you know, the chrome rally wheel type yeah. things on it. And one of them, the last time I had the tires balanced, it has a little shake to it, and the technician's like, yeah, you got a bent wheel, and the tire shop's not going to address that. But since then, we now have our own tire mounting machine, our own balancing. We do all that in-house.
Right.
So I'm going to identify which one is the culprit, and there might be more than one, mm-hmm. and dismount those tires, and going to attempt to straighten the wheels.
Cool.
With a okay. hydraulic, like a porta power and a fixture. And
all right.
I've seen this done before. I saw it on YouTube. So,
hey. I'm a YouTube certified mechanic, sir.
I'm a wheelwright on YouTube. but I've been to wheel repair places and uh-huh. watched them straighten the rims. And it's just all a matter of fixturing it up. And then you make kind of a shoe, if you will, that is curved, like a brake shoe looking thing. Mm-hmm. And you got to push in the right spot and push out. Hopefully it's bent outward. You know, most yeah. guys are bent. They're bent inward. I mean, you know, when you hit something.
Right.
And then you spin it and you keep doing that until it's gone.
I mean, it sounds like body work or like framework when you put your frame on a jig. And if you need to straighten it out, you yeah. put chains on certain points and you pull it into shape. That's kind of it. The same concept, right?
Yeah. It gets a little hairy if the whole thing's like it has a wobble.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that's a different story. But if it's just an impact, you know, flat spot or something. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, too, that a lot of tire shops won't take the time to do is what you're balancing is your wheel and tire assembly. Mm-hmm. Tires and wheels are balanced totally different on their own. And there are times when you can dismount a tire and spin it to a different place on the wheel. And right. the imbalance in the tire will cancel out the imbalance of the other side of the wheel.
Oh.
And it might not fix it, but it'll require less of a weight or...
I gotcha.
You know, when you're dynamic balancing them to make them less crazy. And the shop that did this just picked up the tires and put them on and said, this is
there
what
you go.
Got. Yeah, because mm-hmm. who's going to take the time to do that?
Right.
You know, unless you tell them, I'll pay your... whatever, $130 an hour to do that.
Ugh.
Yeah. And not guarantee any success either. But luckily, I can do that after hours at the shop.
Yeah, perfect. Nice, man. Boy, see, having a shop pays dividends.
Yeah. Yeah. As I say this, having done all this stuff in my home garage.
Right. You know, right.
But the tire machine is a good one. So.
Yeah. And there's times when you really need that kind of heavy equipment. So it's nice to have it.
And, you know, the fun thing is we have a couple of new technicians. We've got a new guy starting tomorrow, as a matter of fact, mechanic. So I'm using this. My plan is to use this tire mount and balance and wheel balance project as an educational seminar for whoever needs the training on the machine or a brush up, which is me.
Well, yeah.
Hopefully Trevor will take a few minutes and give me some pointers on it.
Beforehand and have a train the trainer session.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I'm not the smartest guy in the room, and I hope I'm not the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah. No doubt. Same. Oh, man. Well, that's good. I'm glad things are moving along with this. And, yeah, it'll be nice to see that Buick again this April.
Yeah, it will be. Hopefully everything continues to go smoothly. And, you know, the shop has – it's funny because I'm tinkering with this stuff, and we've got all these – you know, big projects going on at the shop, which is awesome too. And it's neat to see the contrast, you know, between me talking about setting a plug gap and in the shop, we're putting chassis on cars and, you know, total driveline swaps. And we're just wrapping up this 69 or 72 Corvette Roadster LS3 6-speed wheel brake suspension upgrade for a customer in Belgium.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah, and he's actually coming to the States to drive it next month.
Oh, nice. It's
going to be cool, yeah.
They're going to be done?
Yeah, we dynoed it the other day.
Oh, good.
Chassis dynoed it, and it made, I think it put right about 440 to the wheels.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah.
That'll be a nice hauler.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It drives wonderfully. I took it for a spin before the interior was even in it, and it was nice then. So now our interior shop did a bunch of stuff, skinned the console and did some custom things and made a few fixes here and there. And it's a nice car. So that's cool.
I love those early C3 Vets from 68. 72 would be my favorite, where they still had the chrome bumpers on the front and back.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes all the difference.
It does. It make all the difference. Yeah, the 73 just had the urethane front and the chrome rear, and then after that it was all urethane, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. And a couple different styles of that, and then the rear, you know, hatch looking window eventually by 78, right?
Right. Yes. Something like that. Yeah.
Although I recently saw one of those that I was never a big fan of, like the 78, 9, 80 cars,
the disco Vets.
Yeah, right. Sort of, but there was a pace car and, you know, a couple things like that. But somebody did one where the entire greenhouse, you know, from the windshield A-pillar all the way to that back glass was completely blacked out.
Ooh.
So the rear was tinted, the side glass was tinted, the top was painted, and then the rest was red, everything down, and it was lowered on a set of forge lines. And it was like a very pure form of that shape.
Yeah.
And it had the urethane or the Enduro, the plastic, whatever the bumpers were. And they worked on that car. It contributed to that,
design.
Instead of looking like, you know, playing the federal rule of crash bumpers like they really were. But that looked great. And I thought, you know, if more people saw that, those cars, those late 70s, early 80s ones would become a lot more popular.
Yeah, well, they probably will just through attrition of other cars, but still, yeah, it sounds like you can really do some good stuff with them.
Well, you could go buy a 68 and then buy a 78 for a tenth of the price.
Yeah, yes.
And for all intents and purposes, it's the same car.
Yeah, yeah, it kind of is. But that's amazing how that shakes out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the interior is different and, of course, the driveline or whatever. But if you want, you know, a cheap, fun LS swap project, I mean, that's a good way to do it.
You could make a Bonneville car out of it.
Yeah, we had talked about that before. Yeah. But that one's gone. We
sold it. All right.
Yeah.
All right. No use beating a dead horse then.
Right. There's other dead horses to beat.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So you got a hat and a coat on. You're still, what'd you say, low 40s up there?
Yeah, low 40s.
So GTO's not coming out today or tomorrow?
No, sir, it is not. It is not. I still need to get that over to Randy, so we still got to pull the engine back out. But he's been really busy with other projects.
Right, right.
So
one more interesting thing that I did this weekend that I'll share. Our buddy Grady owns an ozone machine.
Yeah, okay.
Right, little box that deodorizes houses and stuff. Uh-huh. And I ran that in the car for about 10 minutes.
In the Riviera?
In the Riv, yeah. Uh-huh. Rolled up all the windows. And don't get me wrong, I love old car smell.
Yeah.
But this one, there was some animal remnant smells here and there, you know, and especially kind of in the heater box. I got to take all that stuff out and you know, scrub it. But I ran the ozone machine for like 10 minutes and then rolled the windows down and opened the doors, because the ozone smell, it's almost like chlorine. I mean, it's like a heavy duty bad smell. Wind blows through it and gone. There is not a smell in the car.
Oh, really?
It's incredible.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. So those who... You know, you get to the point where the car is, you know, doing well and somebody gets in it, you know, if your significant other gets in the car and says, you know, or the kids, you know, what's that smell? That an ozone shot will fix that. And I don't know for how long, but definitely for a while, I guess.
Yeah, so, well, theoretically it could do it forever, because ozone kills the bacteria that makes your smells.
Yeah.
So as long as nothing new is introduced, it should stay smelling nice.
Yeah, yeah. And I know a lot of local repair shops do that service.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out of the COVID thing. You know, people were...
Oh, right.
Were trying to find services to sterilize cars for customers.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was hot and heavy to go out and buy an ozone machine.
Yeah.
And then that kind of died out. But, you know... I recommend that if you got something that you've scrubbed or whatever and it ain't working, see if one of your local repair shops has one of those machines and have them go to town on it. It works.
Yeah, I think some detail shops use that to get like musty smells out.
Yeah.
Things like that too. For sure.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah. Good stuff.
All kinds of little tips this time.
Nice. It's a nice tip episode of V8 Radio.
It's like a show about cars.
How about that? That's crazy. You're crazy.
Yeah, well, we turned the corner here. And speaking of all that, I know there's a lot of interest, I can tell, in our trivia questions.
Yes. Yeah, the interest is mounting. Okay. Let's do this. Let's let the cat out of the bag here. So, Kevin, I asked you when GM started using that coded resistor keys, and for the bonus, I asked you what car they started on, and you talked about how Corvettes had the highest theft rate in the world and a shelf life of 24 hours if they kind of parked them in the city. And you are correct. It did come out for the Corvette, but the year was just a little off.
It was 86.
Came out in the 86 Corvette. Yes, sir.
That was my second guess.
Yeah. But close. I mean, you were right there. I mean, you zoomed in exactly on why it happened and what they started on. So good for you.
So I can still go out and steal an 85.
Yeah, absolutely. All day long. All day long. Without any problem.
Well, and I think, interestingly, what happened is even the earlier car theft went down because thieves... You know, thieves aren't the brightest people in the world. They're crafty, but all of a sudden, the new Corvettes, nobody could steal them. So the whole Corvette got ignored all of a sudden.
Oh, I see. Started going after other cars.
Word on the street was like, oh, you can't steal those Corvettes. So all of them benefited from that.
Okay.
Which was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Okay. Well, your trivia question was... what was the 2002 Daytona 500 pace car, and why was it significant?
Mm-hmm.
And your answer was a damn good one. It was the 2002 Pontiac Grand Prix GTP, because it was perhaps the first front driver in the Daytona as a pace car, which makes 100% sense. Unfortunately, it's not correct.
Ah, man.
The correct answer is the 2002 Pontiac Firebird Trans Am.
Oh, man.
And it was significant because it was the last one. Last Trans Am.
Ah.
Yeah.
Nice.
And if you remember, it was yellow with a black top, greenhouse, tinted with, I think, a black 17-inch wheel and an LS. And it was
nice.
An interesting car, and I was reflecting earlier today because, you know, of course, Daytona's on, and I was fortunate enough back in 2002, I got flown to Daytona by GM to interview Tony Stewart and Jay Leno about that car.
No kidding.
Yeah, and that's where I met Leno, I think. And it was kind of funny because they brought a handful of the TV shows. And I was doing Hot Rod. And of course, back then, there was only a handful of TV shows anyway.
Right.
This is, you know, pre-big time internet. Mm-hmm. And so you got Motor Trend and you got Motor Week. Remember Motor Week?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love Motor Week.
Yeah, it's a good show. Those guys were there. And then Car and Driver had a thing there. And, you know, a lot of the Driving Gloves books and then us. Mm. And I could tell by talking to the other producers that, you know, they're going to. This is like a press junket for a movie. It's going to be the same questions over and over again. You know.
Sure.
It was Tony Stewart's. It was Jay Leno's first time in a pace car,
okay.
So that was a big question, you know. And he had his, you know, yeah, well, you know, it's just like, you know, whatever. And I didn't want to do the same thing as everybody else.
Right.
So at the last minute, I'm like, what can I do different? You know.
Yeah.
So instead of, we ended up doing a kind of a feature on the car. Without those two guys, we did I remember half of the TV episode was on the Trans Am and history of the Trans Am and then this car. And I think I had one of those as a press car for about a week in LA. It was cool. It was a great car. Loved
nice.
It. But the interview was, hey, Tony Stewart's a NASCAR driver, but can he do stand-up comedy? So Jay, let's have Tony do stand-up. And then Tony, let's put Jay on the Super Speedway and see if he can drive.
Nice.
And it was pretty funny. So I had to write jokes for Tony Stewart, like right now, you know, so I'm scribbling this stuff out.
Boy, it just flew in and boy, are my arms tired.
yeah. Well, I only remember one and in specific. And I said, okay, Tony, here's the deal. The camera's going to start rolling and I'm just going to hold this thing up. And I just want you to read it from where you're sitting. Right. And he's like, well, I can't barely even see that. I'm like, well, it's even better. You know, it really has to appear horrible. So, you know, okay, camera rolls, ready, 3, 2, 1, go. I hold the paper up and Tony squints at the paper and he goes, what's the difference between driving on the 405 freeway and racing at Daytona? It's okay to trade paint at Daytona. And he's like, really? And then we cut to Leno. Yeah, boy, that's terrible. You know? You can't tell it. So it actually came out to be a pretty funny segment. And Jay remembered it. And Tony Stewart remembered it. Every time I see him, we chat about that. So
nice.
That's pretty cool. Yeah,
that's right. Cool. That's very cool, man.
But that was about that car.
Mm.
20 years ago, for crying out loud.
Heavens to Betsy. That's crazy.
New Firebird and Trans Am consumers have been sans Trans Am for 20 years.
That's criminal.
Yeah.
That's too bad. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well.
Well, and it is what it is.
Yeah. So, not to end on a low note, but it was a great car. How about that?
Hey, how about that?
You can still buy them. Go get one.
Yeah.
And here's one more interesting bit of news. There's a podcast measuring source called Listen Notes.
Okay.
And they've logged so far that there's 2.78 million podcasts out there at this
Holy
point.
Holy cats.
V8 Radio ranks in the top 3%.
What?
For sure. Yeah, according to them.
Well, they are the authority.
Apparently, they're on the internet.
Nice. It's got to be true.
So, you know, there's your gratification for listening. You've tuned in to one of the top 3% of podcast programs on the entire planet. So
love it.
Not a waste of time.
No, we are important. We're influencers.
Right. For And on that note, I think I got to get in the house and influence some dishes and laundry at this point.
Right. Same here, man. That's right. Influence some dinner.
Yeah. So, as always, we appreciate you tuning in. And, you know, like we said before, if you have thoughts, share them. Give us a review. Subscribe on the iTunes. That seems to be working. We got a little bump this past time, so that was fun. Yeah. Appreciate that. And that's about all I got, unless you got any other stories.
No, man. I'm good to go.
Right on. Me too. So for Mr. Q-Ball Clark, I'm Kevin Oste, reminding you to, let's see. What do we want to say this time? Keep setting the pace.
Nice.
We'll see you next time on VA Radio.